Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, welcome to the 416th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patron Max Goldberg. Check out his awesome work at maxgoldbergdp.com. I'm Matt Enlow.
And I'm Oren Kaplan, and today we have Brenton Geiser on the podcast. He is a doc filmmaker, a commercial filmmaker, and most importantly, I think you would agree, Matt, a longtime fan of the Just Shoot It podcast. I've actually worked with him before. He hired me to do some VFX on one of his documentaries, which it's kind of cool. Out of the blue, reached out. Yeah, now I've kind of worked with a few of our listeners, so kind of cool. And he said, hey guys, I would love to talk about my new documentary. It's called The 50. It's a really cool story. It's about this ongoing program in the California prison system where they take prisoners that are in prison for life and they teach them how to be substance abuse counselors to basically help other prisoners in the prison system. And it was kind of this big solution of how to find people that would do this job and also at the same time help rehabilitate like a lot of these prisoners. And they, you know, they found people that really needed a purpose and I think some goals, and he made this documentary and they filmed inside prisons and they filmed people that have gone through the program in the past. But aside from that, he also just has like a really pretty visually beautiful body of work of past documentary films and commercials and things that he's done, which we don't really get into during this conversation, which is why I'm mentioning it right now.
Yeah, no, his work is really, really awesome. Part of the thing that we sparked to was that Brenton also kind of found filmmaking a little later in life. He had another career. He was in tech. We talk about it a decent amount. But, you know, it's a great story. He is so motivated and so smart and so talented that, like, the rate at which he accelerated was very quick. Like, he went from, like, you know, no reel to really awesome work very, very quickly, which is so cool. But I think it serves as an inspiration and as a guide for listeners who maybe like felt like they stalled out or maybe want to pivot. Maybe they're a DP and they want to direct, or a producer who wants to direct, or a director who wants to be a DP, or whatever that may be. You know, I think this is a really inspiring story for people who are looking to pivot in some way as well.
I'm always fascinated by documentaries and the different muscles that the documentary filmmakers flex compared to what narrative filmmakers flex. So it's fun. It's fun to talk about. And it is nice to know about other people that have obligations and responsibilities in their lives and how they manage to make ends meet. Just, literally, our podcast should be called Making Ends Meet, about splicing film together and also and not going broke while you're doing it. Making Ends Meet. pod.com. Anyhow, anything else you want to talk about before we get into it?
Yeah, our Patreon, patreon.com/justshootitpod, is the place where you can throw us a buck or two to support the show. By the time this episode drops, we will have done another live show, right?
Yeah, and what's crazy to me is that we told people that it is free for patrons, right? And so you could be a patron for 1 month for $1 and then stop being a patron. And you've given us $1 and you've gotten free tickets to the show, which are $5 each. So most people are getting two tickets, so they're spending $10 when they could be spending $1. And I get that nobody wants to sign up for a subscription, but literally you have 10 months to cancel your subscription for it to be a better deal than just buying the tickets.
And that assumes that you only go to one event this year. We're doing more of these events, but that's just one of the many great reasons that you should be a patron.
The number one reason is, you know, to keep this podcast going.
Yeah. But I was thinking about it. I was like, people are still motivated through self-interest. So saving money, getting early access, all of that stuff is still valuable. And we are going to start doing Patreon-only segments as well in the near future. So sign up now.
I will say we had an episode where we discussed this lawyer that a lot of people in the commercial world use who negotiates contracts for filmmakers signing deals with production companies. And someone on our Patreon, one of our patrons, reached out yesterday and said, hey, who's that person? And I sent them that person's contact info. So, you know, it is another direct line to us. Obviously, you can always email us, just shootapod@gmail.com, and we will most likely read it. But for some reason, I feel a little more obligated to respond to the 100%. Patron messages.
And it's a little more fun to, like, interact with people there, so...
You know, oh yeah, their UI for messaging is just incredible.
I'm saying it's like, oh, you know that the people who are subscribed to the Patreon are like, it's more of a community.
Real listeners.
Yeah, not just real listeners, but people who like have an interest and stake in the community that we're trying to build. And so that feels cool as well, you know?
Yeah. I wonder, you know, like when people start like talking about their Patreon on a podcast and you just like hit the forward 30 seconds button. And then you hit it like two times or three times. Mm-hmm. This Patreon section is like 3 minutes long. Like people are going to have to hit it like 10 times.
I keep them guessing.
Yeah, maybe six times. I guess it's 3 minutes. But anyhow, patreon.com/justshootitpod. Sorry to tell you, you did not skip far enough ahead of this Patreon promotion segment to manage to miss it. But now it's over. patreon.com/justshootitpod. Okay. On with the show.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
We're here with Brenton Geiser, my former employer. Welcome to the podcast. Matt loves it. He loves it when I get jobs from the podcast and he doesn't. It just makes him so happy.
We've both gotten jobs from the podcast. It's purely, the jealousy is only in that Oren gets recognized more than I do.
Yeah.
That's it.
Anyhow, Brenton, you're a doc filmmaker. Mm-hmm. You have a new movie that's coming out, The 50. Congrats.
Thanks so much. Appreciate that. Yeah.
The trailer looks awesome. The topic awesome. Looks awesome. We're going to get really into it. But aside from you being a fan of the podcast, oh, actually, maybe we'll start with that. We usually get this stuff off the mic, but Matt was insistent that we should hear this on the mic. Tell us a little bit about how you, how Just Shoot a Pod has affected your life.
So let's start with the praise and go from there. Yeah, that works. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of a, it's a real story, guys. Like I mean it when I say, and this, there sounds like a bit of, insincerity in my voice right now. I feel it, but honestly, you guys were one of the first podcasts, because what we'll be talking about a little bit today is my transition into filmmaking. And one of the first podcasts I came across during that time was you guys. And I've listened to them all. And for whatever reason, you guys have just really stuck. It's one of those things that, like, every Thursday in the car after dropping off my kids, I turn it on. And it's funny, seeing Matt today, I haven't talked to Matt Oren. You and I have talked before, we met before, right, and stuff like that. But seeing the voice and the face and all that stuff connected was a cool thing, you know? So, like, big fan of the podcast. I appreciate what you guys bring to the table.
You told us that in your 30s is when you kind of made your transition to being a filmmaker, and that you had to do it fast because you needed to make a living. Mm-hmm. You couldn't just, like, you weren't just dabbling, sleeping on your friend's couch.
I'm going to quote your email. I directed my first short film and TV commercial at 32 years old with a baby on the way, needing to make this into a sustainable career right out of the gate. And at that point, I was like, oh, yeah, we need to have this guy on, because I don't know how I would do that. Right. Like,
yeah.
Tell us about that transition.
Yeah. I mean, it was, without getting too deep into kind of the personal aspects of it all, like, I started off like you, Oren, I started off in tech. I'm from the Bay Area, grew up in a small town here called Half Moon Bay. And what was, like, looked available to me, like, coming out of college, was opportunities in tech. So I kind of ran with that, found my way kind of in business development, marketing, a little bit of product work as well, and started to build a career that at a certain point just became a little bit, you know, just, I guess, vacant of any true feeling or connection, you know? I think in Silicon Valley, and you know this, Oren, right? Like, you get sold this idea that you're changing the world. You get sold this idea that every single thing you are doing is of meaning. And after a while, I found that to be kind of false, right? So sure. Yeah, like you said,
it's the Silicon Valley joke of, like, we're making the world a better place by efficiently delivering pizzas to people for less than minimum wage.
By replacing people with machines and making billions of dollars. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the beginning of every single mission statement in Silicon Valley. And so, you know, that was kind of my trajectory for a while. I went and I worked at a company called change.org, which was an awesome experience. I was doing director of business development over there for a while. I was doing that work and, you know, I guess moving into my 30s, there was a time, if I'm being honest, there was a time, a darker time of real kind of intense depression. And, you know, and I'm talking about, like, multiple years at this point, you know? And so there was this intentionality that I kind of mustered up at a certain point. And I remembered, I hearkened back to a time when I was a kid, and I remember what I loved. My first love as a kid was actually to draw, and then ultimately to paint, and all this stuff before I found sports, which took over my life at, you know, probably by age of 10 or something like that. That was how I expressed myself for the longest time. So I remember in this mode of desperation, I was like, I got to find a way to kind of express myself in a similar way that was, like, safe for me. That was also private, and that allowed me to just express in a way beyond words, beyond any kind of typical way of expression, right? So the lowest barrier to entry for me was the camera. So I ended up grabbing my first DSLR and I just started shooting street photography. And that's where I learned, you know, composition. I learned lighting a little bit, you know, with toppy daylight, navigating that stuff. But I also learned that I loved meeting people and that the camera was an opportunity to connect and to investigate and find out more about people.
While you're going through this exploration, you're finding street photography, you're evolving into what will eventually become like a fully fledged documentary filmmaker. Are you still working that day job? Are you still at change.org? Like or is it something where you're like, I'm quitting cold turkey?
No, great question. Yeah. So I quit change.org, but I actually went off and I started my own startup, just a small startup that ultimately just wasn't working, right? We weren't able to find what we call product market fit. I still remember some terminology from back in the day. And it was during that time that kind of starting that company, that slow kind of drawn out failure gave me the space to both investigate street photography and how I held it together during that time was actually driving Lyft and Uber and all that.
Pursuing the arts, especially in an industry town, in your case, a technology town, but like any sort of town, like it's very clearly deprioritized by the time you hit adolescence because it's not going to quote unquote pay any bills or pay off in any meaningful way. And like as Americans, we're programmed to think that the only worthwhile pursuits are essentially capitalist ones, right?
100%. Yeah.
Right. Like earning power, which is, well said, you know, always so frustrating because like, whether you're in tech or something else, you almost always need to utilize your creativity, you know, and creativity is captured a lot of different ways. Like, are you sketching, you know, for your PowerPoint presentation? Actually, maybe, honestly, like there's so many, especially now that things are multidisciplinary and that everything is multimedia. Like, I think there's going to be a pretty significant gap between young people who were able to pursue the arts and then also people who were discouraged from it in a multimedia world, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas like our kids' age, they're all going to know how to edit on their phones better than we can, you know?
Yeah, for sure. There's a shift back, like especially with the DSLR revolution where everyone basically could learn f-stops and aperture speed, you know, apertures and shutter speeds and all that. And now with phones, like, and the whole, you know, content creator revolution, like the fact, like being a creator is no longer this like afterthought, you know? Now it seems more likely to have a successful money-making career as a creator than as a professional football player, you know, where it definitely did not used to be the case.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there's absolutely more of a long tail in that content creation world now that we're seeing just unfold right in front of us, right? So, yeah, but I mean, to Matt's point, you know, I think, you know, also I'm first generation Korean American on my mom's side, you know, and so, you know, we know the stereotypes that come with kind of the Asian American baggage of needing to kind of like find your way in that way is narrow. My mom was quite contrarian, so she wasn't necessarily pushing me down a certain path, right? But nonetheless, yeah, I mean, I think that's a palpable thing that we all kind of either embrace or fend off. And yeah, and for me, you know, drawing and painting as a young kid, it was like the only thing I did, but it never was a thought of like, you know, I never attached that to like my own purpose as a kid or what I was going to do or anything like that. Right. But you know, when you turn 30, things shift. And, you know, and there's stakes, sure. There's expenses.
And you look at around at your lawyer friends who are all quitting
yeah.
because they're miserable or never got a job because there were too many of them, right?
Yeah.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. Very true. So I was right there with my lawyer friends, right? Trying to figure out what's next, right?
Right.
But I hit the streets with a camera and that kind of was.
And were you married at that time?
I was. Yeah. Yeah. So my wife and I.
Did your wife have like a real job?
She did. The chocolate yes, you were eating before we started recording okay. right there.
Alter Eco.
She was a marketing manager over there.
See, that's where Matt and I went wrong. Anyhow.
It's the non-actor wives. Yeah.
it's not the, you know.
I think we nailed it, Oren.
We of course nailed it. We were married to amazing people, but we could not run around town photographing cool, interesting people while our wives were,
It's
heads
not,
of marketing at the chocolate factory.
It's not as glamorous as you think, because my wife and I, we both kind of went our own, my wife runs a yoga Pilates studio for moms now, both online and in person and all that. So we're in the Bay, where once again, the cost of living is outrageous. So we've always had to have each other's back. Like there was the time when I shifted into photography and filmmaking, she held it down. During the time when she decided to move from where she was before into what she's doing now, I held it down. So we've always kind of changed that. Made that exchange. Yeah. And it's
to me, like when I talk to young people and they are figuring out about settling down versus like pursuing their career, like to me, that's like if you can find the person that is cool with like trading off with you, kind of passions and income, that's kind of like the key, I think.
I don't think when you first, I know we're getting into a relationship podcast real quick, but I think when you first meet somebody, right? Mm-hmm. Like all the things, all the trade-offs they're going to have to consider 10 years fast forward, there's no way to know, right? It's a crapshoot, right? But I think probably all of us are lucky enough. I mean, knowing you guys are married to actors, right? Me being married to an entrepreneur myself, it's hard, and there's times where it's not as elegant and perfect as it seems, but you just figure it out day by day.
A nice thing that occurred to me about entrepreneurs and artists being together is that both groups' lifestyles are so erratic. Do you know what I mean? We know people who like had a hard time when it was like their partner was a 9-to-5 normal person and they liked their job and they showed up and did good work, and then the weekends and the evenings were theirs. And maybe they'd have to answer some emails here or there or whatever, but they weren't like going to mixers or flying to a foreign country to shoot something, or just, people who have like stable, normal lives plus the chaos of an artistic life, especially when you're hustling and still trying to build a client base and all of that stuff. That's complicated. So like at least an entrepreneur is like, hey, I got to go take this client to dinner. I'll see you tomorrow. That's
going to lose nice, in a sense. Shitload of money this month, and maybe we'll make some money next month. Yeah.
That is, that's succinctly put. Yeah. That's the conversation at the end of each month. Yeah.
But so as you and your partner are trading off, you guys are taking care of each other, you found street photography. When does that go from, hey, I like talking to people, to like, oh, I'm a documentarian?
Yeah, kind of quickly. I mean, so basically I knew photography stills wasn't going to be the end all be all for me. I always once I found storytelling through photography, it was a process of adding on. I started a documentary photo project with my friend Felix Uribe. And we did audio interviews of different subjects, and we did day in the life kind of work with different people in the Tenderloin in San Francisco. And, to me, kind of just this interweaving of different forms of media, layering on, just became something interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And so I knew film and video and motion was going to be my trajectory. I didn't know when and how exactly. And also one other thing that I didn't really consider until I was on my first commercial set directing was how much I loved being part of a team. Like I alluded to before, I dedicated my early life to sports. And it was such a integral part of my upbringing, being parts of large groups of people with one single goal. And so I remember going to I'm fast forwarding a little bit, but being on my first commercial set that I was directing, and I had no clue what I was doing. We had a crew of four people and we had 40 extras. Nothing above board or anything.
You said your crew was four people total and you had 40 extras?
Yep. Yeah.
Gotcha. Did these 40 extras know that they were in the movie?
They were paid extras. Yeah, yeah. It wasn't just like long lanes taking people off the street.
Yeah. Yeah, Venice Beach or anything.
It's like, you're a street photographer. You get like all these people background for free, right? So the ratio was weird on that one. Yeah.
So tell us, like, yeah, how did you get your first paid job? I mean, your pitch to us was that you kind of had to make money fast. How did that look?
Yeah, so basically, I think what happened as a photographer, you know, like I alluded to, I was dabbling in my own kind of projects that were getting a little bit of recognition in San Francisco. And so I was getting hired to do...
when you say recognition, yeah. Blogs are getting written about you, you have an art show. What does recognition look like in a different environment?
Both.
Or in San Francisco, yeah. Is what I mean to say.
Exactly. Yeah. Like those two things, not to like a massive extent or anything like that, but I think me and my friend Felix were doing something novel and I think true. I think people felt there was a real kind of essence behind what we were trying to do with that project, Tender Souls, that I was alluding to. Mm-hmm. You know, I was on, you know, not to go too far back, but I was on a board of a nonprofit in the Tenderloin. And the Tenderloin is a small little neighborhood right in the middle of San Francisco, where most of the people who live on the margins are actually right in the middle. And so we did a storytelling project in there. And so I was getting hired by a lot of nonprofits to do different storytelling photography work for them. That started to bleed across the street to where tech companies were starting to hire me. They're like, all right, this guy understands people. He's, you know, he has this kind of authentic lensing into culture and people and all that. Maybe we could hire him. So that became kind of a process for me. And then in the Bay, you know, most of the work in video specifically is client direct. You know, a lot of the successful production companies in the Bay, you know, they have deep relationships with Facebook, with Google, and all that kind of stuff. So the barrier to getting work in video from a photography standpoint isn't as massive a barrier as it is to get a true like commercial directing broadcast spot, right? Mm-hmm. That goes through an agency. So I think I got really lucky.
So on a practical level, as a for instance, because when you say client direct, the client is the brand, right?
Yep.
And they're just like, hey, we need somebody who can shoot something for us.
I mean, it's kind of like industrials, right? Like,
right, yeah,
is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Right? eBay is like, we got to make some videos for this thing. Let's hire someone that makes videos.
Yeah, that's most of what happens in the Bay, honestly. I mean, there are some larger campaigns that go straight to a production company too from Google that's like pushing out a product, and some of those might, you know, get a large ad buy, mainly digital, maybe some broadcast, but that's, you know, that's kind of rare. I mean, they still have their own agencies and internal agencies and all that. But for
me, did you know people at these different companies? You know, you've got a buddy at eBay who puts in a good word, or is it like friends of friends? Like how do those networks form?
Yeah. Okay. So it was two things. I'll say two things. Like one was that I had been working in kind of tech for 9 years in business development, right? So I had this like business acumen I was able to leverage. I kind of knew how to speak and sell myself a bit. You know, I was naive. I didn't know what I was doing, but I was at least bold enough, maybe desperate enough to be able to put myself out there. So there was that part. And there were some relationships I carried over as well. But I think once again, like with some of those early photo projects and people seeing my early work, I was able to have some type of proof of concept to put in front of nonprofits, then ultimately businesses. And how I got, to be specific, how I got my first commercial directing job, which is very different from like the commercial directing Oren and you, Matt, do, you know, you guys both do.
That's why I'm pressing, because I'm like, I literally do not understand how you do. So you have a portfolio. You've done the project, right? You level up through nonprofits all the way up, right? So yeah, give us your anecdote here.
So this one specifically, so I'll center myself on one specific commercial project, because from there it was just like kind of one thing to the next. But I got hit up by a organization in the Bay Area, a transportation organization, right? There's a few of them. There's like BART, AC Transit, Muni, you know, stuff like that. And they wanted me to shoot billboards for them. And they also had a bid out to try to actually do like a broadcast spot. And so when I saw that, I pitched them the idea of actually me directing their broadcast spot. Mm-hmm. I said, you know, I don't have a large body of work. You could see some of my work. I already did my short documentary at that point. But I have a small kind of production team that I could cobble together. I could do your billboards, and at the same time, I could actually shoot this commercial, and we could kind of expand and explore what this is. And honestly, it wasn't the most sophisticated thing. It was like they had their equivalent of boards that they sent me was like this very lifestyle-y kind of 15-second, just like kind of like visual motion-based mood board. So from there, like, what I'm getting at is with smaller commercial jobs like that, that happen in smaller locales, right? These marketing teams that are directly trying to contract out filmmakers, right, to make this stuff, they're in desperate need to close that gap. Like, right, they have like some type of like inspiration, like, oh, I like this YouTube video that I saw that this other transit organization did in Minneapolis, right? Can you do something like that? So there's a huge opportunity that I found where you can then kind of build a creative, like there's a little sparkle of what they wanted there, but you could essentially build a creative from the ground up. And I think with a lot of the smaller jobs I did, you know, 5-6 years ago, that's kind of the MO and the approach I took. And that's kind of how I started to build my portfolio, if that makes sense.
I see. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Cool. So that was your first kind of paid commercial job, is these billboards that turned into like a broadcast campaign?
Yeah. Yeah. So that wasn't my first photo. I was doing a lot of photo stuff prior to that, but yeah, that, we did a commercial with a famous Bay Area rapper. We did a 30-second spot that was, that I think ran in the Bay for about like four months or so. So it ran for a while.
So now you're kind of making money as a doc filmmaker. Are you also owning the production company?
Yeah. So during that time, I mean, I was essentially just freelancing, doing my own stuff.
You were directing and producing.
Directing and producing, exactly. Yeah. So I would bring in most kind of smaller projects. And we're talking like, you know, we're not talking six-figure projects at this time, right? We're talking small crews.
Bay Area, sorry to interrupt, but it's just so bonkers because your clients, like here in LA, you know, we'll have a client that's like a movie, you know, a $20 million movie wants to do like a promo campaign, or like this food company, Sweetgreen, wants to do that, you know, this commercial for their salad or something. And they'll be like, okay, we'll spend $1 million on this commercial. And then in the Bay Area, you have like Google, multi like $1 trillion company. And they're like, we'll spend 10 grand on our commercial. The ratios of how big these companies are and how much they think they need to spend on like marketing is just like totally insane. Cause I know like from living in the Bay Area and working a tiny bit in the Bay Area, like, you know, people are trying to look for deals, even though they're just cause you're working for like some of the biggest companies in the universe doesn't mean you're getting like giant budgets, you know?
Yeah. It's a massive sliding scale, right? You could be doing anything as like low budget as event stuff on behalf of Google or Meta to like massive ad campaigns, which of course usually the Bay Area production companies are touching, right? But there's, you know, I think the thing why like Sweetgreens is so different from like a Meta or Google, of course, like Meta or Google, they are a B2C, B2B. They're just a massive, massive company that needs to create content across so many different products, right? You know, basically what a directing career, like I said, in the Bay early stages is just like cobbling together small project after small project and seeing which one you could really kind of experiment and explore with, right? So you figure out what those are. You figure out which ones are going to be just, you know, feeding family and kids and all that, and which ones you're going to take a much smaller cut of because there's something there that you could really explore and expand on. So that was kind of my model for a while, and it still
is.
And
when you say you take a smaller cut of, because you are essentially the production company as well, you're saying like, oh, how much of a margin am I going to make? If it's something a little more industrial, a little less artistically fulfilling, you're going to get paid on it. But if it's like, oh, this is special and it's worth it for me to get a gimbal operator for the day or whatever, that's an investment in your career and your company, essentially.
Totally. Yeah. So that's always the kind of thing I'm weighing. And I think all of us do, right? And I still, like I said, I, you know, 6 years in, I still do this to that day or to this day. But specifically, that's what it kind of looks like. You know, sometimes you meet with have it be through an agency or have it be through just a company direct, and you'll see a marketing team that wants to do something unique and they like your work for whatever reason. And you know, you could explore something kind of unique that, you know, one could represent their brand, but two can like really be something special for your reel. And three might be able to allow you to explore something technical that you've never done before. So I'm always kind of looking for those opportunities, and I'm willing to not take as much if it's coming through my production company, you know, because I think it's, you know, it's an investment in kind of the bigger, larger body of work. And then in the Bay, like I said, you know, you have those other projects that might be, you know, more talking heads, interviews with the bigger tech company, stuff like that to kind of feed the company, feed the beast, so to speak.
Give us the log line real quick and then kind of how you came upon this project.
Yeah, sure. So the 50 is about the first 50 men that went through this breakthrough rehabilitation program while serving life sentences in a California state prison. And they all became substance abuse counselors during their time in prison.
Can I ask a stupid question?
Yeah, go for it.
When you serve a life sentence, is there any chance you get out?
So there's a couple different versions of that, right? There's like 25 to life, so to speak, right? So you'll have a parole option. You could be potentially go in front of the board at 25 years, right? And might be found suitable at that time. Also on good behavior, you might be able to go in front of the board prior to that. There's also life without parole. But even with life without parole, we've seen a few times where people have actually gotten out because of good behavior and because of different rehabilitative efforts that they put in. So it's a good question, but yeah, that's why you hear that range, right? So it's usually, you know, life is like the furthest extent, the furthest sentence possible.
Yeah. Right. So these 50 men are all kind of on the spectrum of this
life. Yeah, there was only, I think, about three or four that had like finite sentences. One of the main characters in the film named Al Wrench, I think he was supposed to serve 20 years. But most of them were like 20 to life, 25 to life, 30 to life, whatever it is. So the vast majority of that group, yeah, they had life sentences. And, you know, I think to make it even more interesting and the stakes even higher, this was all during a time in the California state prison system where there was mass overcrowding. The U.S. government came down on CDCR and said that basically it was unconstitutional the way they were actually operating these prisons. And so there was a huge, like a huge need to basically look at innovative ways to reduce the prison population during that time. And rehabilitation out of desperation became one of them. And this program came out. OMCP came out because of that. Yeah.
Cool. And so how did you find it and think to do a documentary about it?
Cool. So basically, I made a short documentary, like I alluded to before. It was a doc called Tender Souls. Once again, it was a story about a few different people in the Tenderloin kind of intertwining. And that story in that film got a good amount of traction within like small circles within the Bay Area specifically. And I had a friend who I was on a board with, once again, who came to me one day and said, I have a story I want to tell you. I met this person and he has this fascinating story. And lucky for me, I was the only filmmaker she knew. You know, once again, if you're in these smaller markets, right, the Rolodex of filmmakers, right, are short, right? And so my small short film was like enough for her to actually want to talk to me about it. So she met this guy named Randy Carter, and Randy Carter was one of the 50. And so while while Randy is telling her, Tracy Lewis, who's one of the producers from the film, the story of him, he's also telling the story of 49 other guys who went through this program, which just transform not only them individually, but the entire prison that they were part of. So Solano State Prison, which was one of, it's an interesting prison because they have a level 2 yard and goes all the way up to level 4. So like maximum security. And it was during a time, once again, with overcrowding, there was a ton of violence, drug saturation was at its peak. And these guys were, through this program, which was such like a against the grain, against the current type of program, which, you know, essentially in many ways was a threat to both the institution and people just kind of running things on the yard, right?
When you say running things, you mean like drug trafficking, essentially, right? Like
drug trafficking, yeah, anything to make money, any hustle, right? People doing the right thing is against the grain and it goes against the prison political system and it's a threat, you know, it's a threat to business as usual. So Randy told this story and, you know, basically the story was that these men, you know, became drug and alcohol counselors after this 6-month program. They kind of looked introspectively into their lives in this like really deep, radically honest way. And ultimately what happened, I'm basically telling the story right now, but ultimately what happened is the culture really shifted within this prison. You know, people who were shot callers, people, like you said, Matt, who were trafficking drugs, you know, would come to these guys and would start to share their stories and got to the source of why they were there, why they were still doing the things they were doing, all those kind of things. So that's kind of the center of it all. But Randy was the person who kind of showed me a glimpse of that story. And then from there, I decided to meet 12 other guys off camera. We had conversations and I know from my own.
And Randy put you in touch with these people and like they called you or how like the logistics of even just speaking to somebody in prison for the purposes of a documentary, you don't know them, any of that. How does that work? You know?
That's a great question. So with the 50, the interesting thing about the 50, this program happened about 13 years ago, or the first 50 basically happened and graduated that, you know, over a decade ago. And so the vast majority of those guys, actually almost all of them are out. They're all out of prison now, right? So we told the story of these guys who are now making like this, their own personal impacts on society on the outside. We also do follow a group of men that actually go through the same program on the inside too. So there's kind of parallel arcs that we're following.
So that program is still going on now.
Still going on now. And it's been kind of expanded on by Gavin Newsom. Yeah.
So how long were you shooting like the actual prison stuff for?
So we started, this first conversation with Randy and then 12 other guys, that was in 2018, beginning of 2018. And I, like I was telling you guys off mic that I know that because like my daughter was born around that time. So easy to track that timeline. But we, you know, so we started with interviews with many of the guys on the outside. We started with some kind of verite and investigating the characters and storylines we wanted to understand. And then by the time
all financed by who?
Yeah. So we were able to raise about like $40,000 initial dollars through just like different philanthropic sources, different small foundations, individuals, stuff like that.
And then are you getting financials, like fiscal sponsorship? Are you a 501c, that sort of thing? Like it's a pure documentary, altruistic sort of situation, pure philanthropy.
Yeah, in those cases it was. Yeah. So we did get equity financing afterwards to get us to our full budget, but we started off, you know, using IDA as our fiscal sponsor. So anybody that came in under that kind of smaller sum, which is $40,000, they could write it off. But I ultimately pitched this film to a financier who also runs a production company called Safe Space, who is a, you know, in association with group when it comes to the 50, right? And so they came on, our EP, Jeff Sobrato, came on to finance the rest of the film and be able to kind of bring it to fruition from there.
Do you know how many days you spent like shooting?
I do. Actually, I don't know exact. I said that so emphatically, but I think about, I would say like 31 or 32. Yeah.
And are you, you're editing and shooting at the same time, like kind of putting things together and figuring out what you need?
This is one of my notes, the biggest notes to self, and I'm going to sound like an idiot to any documentary filmmaker listening. I was so scared of like cracking open that RAID hard drive with like the hundreds of hours of footage. And, you know, and of course we had assistant editors and stuff like that, orging and all that kind of stuff. But actually like putting together a timeline and starting to like do some type of assembly cut and all that. I waited to pretty long. I waited to probably like 20 some odd days of filming before I even started doing that, which is absolutely the worst way to go. But what we did do, if we're getting kind of inside baseball in terms of like the editing process, you know, we made transcripts of every single interview as they came in. We started doing a paper edit pretty early. So me and our senior editor, Stephen Dupree, who's an incredible editor, we were at least on paper putting together like that 4 hour, just straight up talking heads cut, you know, without any of the verite moments and all that. But in terms of actually opening up Premiere and like editing scenes and all that, that actually came, we probably started doing that, I would say early 2020, right around the pandemic. Yeah. The beginning.
Oh, crazy. So you'd been shooting for like 2 years before you even started cutting stuff together.
I would say about a year and a half, maybe 13 months or so. Yeah. Once again, awful idea. Never, please do not do that. But yeah, that's how we did it. Yeah.
Was it hard to get access to shoot in prisons? Like, I've always kind of wondered about that.
The interesting thing about this story, like, you know, how I told you, it's a story of success, a story of something that actually the Department of Corrections did correct, you know? Mm-hmm. And we don't pull punches. We are very open about like the situation and context that led to this, why this actually happened. It wasn't necessarily by the wisdom of CDC, or it was by the pressure that the US government put on them, right? But because once again, this is the program that they tout and they celebrate the most. It's called the Offender Mentor Certification Program, OMCP. They, you know, they really were amenable and they were helpful. Their media team was like incredibly gracious and supportive. So we got full access, you know, and I think once we got past the CDCR media team, we got sign off to get into Solano State Prison and film. Once we got into the building, into the program, I think because the program, the crux of it is really about people telling their own stories and investigating their own stories, that access, like true access, which means people opening up in front of the cameras, that I don't want to say that was easy, but because once again, it's part of the program in itself. There's already that honesty and authenticity that lives in those men, that it was much easier than it would be in a different kind of circumstance. Yeah.
Did you get to like walk around the prison and shoot a little bit?
Yeah.
Did you have to ask everyone that was in the prison for permission? Like, how, give us some of the interesting, like,
inside
how it's done. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. So we had the cool thing. We had this guy named John Ojo, who was, I forget his exact title, but he was one of the main guys on the communication team at CDCR. And he was escorting us around. He was walking with us and all that kind of stuff. And he's one of these super unique people that used to be a corrections officer, but has respect both from the CO front and also the incarcerated people front as well. Because he treats people with a level of kindness and respect across the board, you know? And so, you know, him guiding us, like, you know, we got permission from everybody that we filmed, right? Sometimes it was like group-based, you know, permission and sign-off, right? Like, we know those kind of crowd releases and all that. But because he was the head of communications, he basically gives his sign-off for everything we do in front of him. But once again, he was kind of like the key to being able to, not just like in the group, like film these very intimate scenes, but also like on the yard. You know, there's, if you watch the film, you'll see these scenes on the yards where people from the 50, I would show them like still frames from what we got the, you know, that week. And they would say, wait, how did you walked on the yard? You went there and you shot that and you talked to them. And I think a lot of it was because of Ojo, and it was, a lot of it was because I think the ethos of the film, honestly, is just about to like is about showing like the true humanity of people that have gone to those places, right? So yeah, we saw a lot. Yeah, we got, but it wasn't, you know, we had some times I got yelled at. I got confronted a few times, you know.
Did you have to like arm wrestle anyone?
Arm wrestle? No, luckily no. No wrestling, no arm wrestling, no anything like that. But like hard conversations.
What camera did you shoot on? And can you tell us a little bit about like the strategy of how you cover like a prison? You know, like, I don't know. To me, the scary thing about docu stuff, and I don't know, Matt, if you agree, but it's like, I'm just like always afraid I'm not going to I'm going to miss something, especially in that type of situation.
We're control freaks, right? So like documentary, you're kind of losing control, but then also there, when you're in a prison where you're allowed to do certain things and not other things, and not unlike other kind of like high traffic or potentially dangerous situations, someone's there to keep you from getting the shot that you want to, like whether that's stepping into traffic or, you know, rubbing someone the wrong way or whatever that may be. Yeah. How do you deal with that? And then technically.
Yeah. No, it's a good question. So, I mean, I think with specifically, you know, it's a different dynamic within group settings when we're actually filming a processing group of men, like 30 men talking about their, you know, their deepest secrets, oftentimes their innermost feelings. That is like traditionally like, you know, typically two camera kind of cross coverage. Usually I'll have one.
They have marks though, right? Like that's a lot easier in a certain sense, right?
Yeah, they have marks. They're in a chair. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, without most of the time without, you know, ACs, you know, we have our DP pulling focus off the lens or on their little follow focus on their camera.
I just thought you were talking about air conditioning. I was like, so sound will be good. That's great.
Yeah, exactly. No, that, you know, yeah, we, of course, our sound guys have the audacity to ask the prison people like, hey, can we turn off this air conditioning? It happened multiple times.
Yeah.
But so that's typically how we cover. They're pretty traditional coverage on that front when it comes to those groups. One on a longer lens, one wider. But like
do you bring lighting in and stuff?
We did. We brought some like tube lights and stuff like that, like to create some edging and all that in certain cases. Most of the time we just shot with what was there, flat, not the prettiest, you know.
What cameras?
We shot mainly on an older red, a Dragon. We shot on some A7s as well, you know. So to the demise of our editorial team, like we shot on way too many cameras. It was a mess. You know, we shot a lot of 16 too. I guess I'm transitioning a little bit outside of prison, but one of the unique things about the film is that, you know, motivated much by the men in the groups telling their childhood stories and kind of understanding the source of so much, that motivated us to do these kind of like visual reenactments that are a little different. I do call them reenactments, but some are much more, I guess, and without trying to sound too pretentious, like visual metaphor more so than literal one for one recrease, you know? But we shot that on, you know, on a SR3, I believe. Yeah. So many cameras.
Is this kind of like the passion project where on the side you're kind of doing commercials and stuff still? Or is there a way to turn like this into the thing that's like paying for your family's like rent or mortgage or whatever?
It paid for a little bit. You know, and I think because most of our team, you know, is most of our team's kind of first feature doc. A lot of us have worked in commercials before, some really amazing commercial producers and all that. And some of on the narrative side, I think we were still kind of finding out the rhythms of like doc filmmaking, which is very, you know, a lot of it is out of your control, as we kind of alluded to before, right? So basically what I'm saying is that budget gets stretched over a lot of time, and it's not enough to be able to, you know, fund your life. So intermittently within making a film, you know, there'll be times where like I'm on a commercial project and I'm taking 2.5 weeks off of doc work to just like focus in on this like bigger client project.
And is it the same? the same team? Like, is everyone from the film moving with you to the commercial project as well, because it's all one, the same production company, or are you kind of dividing and conquering, or are they day players where they're only doing one project?
Yeah, there's a lot of overlap, but everybody's kind of their own kind of freelance entity, right? So like, you know, my DPs that I worked with on the 50, I'll work on commercial projects with. My producer, Esteban Padilla, you know, we work together quite a lot. He's a director as well, and there's a lot of overlap in our work as well. So nothing's formal in that. You know, I'm not from the 50, we didn't create like a doc production company that then just kind of like, you know, does some branded docs on the side. Really, I've been trying to like build out my documentary career and at the same time build out a commercial career, which, you know, live in parallel paths but don't really overlap.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, super subjective question that there's no answer to, but do you think as a documentary filmmaker, it's more important to be able to like talk to people on set and get good shots and understand cameras and cinematography and, you know, interviews, technique, or do you think it's more important to be a good editor to like understand how scenes cut together and how a story is made? I mean, obviously they're both important, but like if you were hiring a director for a documentary, which is the thing that you would focus on, I think is the most important part?
Yeah, no, that's an incredible question. I mean, I've kind of come to, and this is beyond documentary, and I'll get back to documentary specific, but I'm starting, and you know, and I do some narrative short work as well, and I write, you know, I write narrative films, and I, you know, have directed shorts, and I have a short on the way coming up, and I'm like coming to this, I don't know if it's conclusion, but I'm coming to this thought that like, I feel like it's so important for directors to have both sides like just covered, writing and editing, like, and everything else kind of meets in the middle. And not to diminish, of course, like working with actors and knowing the technical side of cameras, but like the foundations are, you know, mm-hmm. the source material, the writing, and then what, how it's all coming together in the end, you know? So like back to your question, Oren, I think it is the editing. I think that's, you know, and it depends on what type of documentary filmmaker you are and the stories you want to tell and all that. But I always like kind of believed, you know, and once again, you know, I'm saying this with a grain of salt, because this is just a person who's done like three short documentary docs in one feature, right? But I feel like every director really needs to get like their hands, you know, dirty in the footage and like really know it inside and out, and be able to cut themselves. And just that's where the story is made so much. And I hope, you know, I think my feedback to myself is like on the next time is to make sure to shorten that feedback loop, right? Like to be constantly editing, constantly shooting, and have those two things inform themselves. But to answer mm-hmm. that, if I was to pick one, I would say editing for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to ask, just to complicate the question even more. Like if your, or in your question was better on set or in post, basically post makes sense. But I thought you were going to divide set into the
technical craft, and the human.
And the human. Yeah, exactly. Right. Cause you like in documentary, yes, your job is to like make sure that everybody looks great and like get some cool Super 16 footage and da, 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 and the gimbal shot and like great establishings, but also it's to interview, right? Or to get people to open up. Right. Whether mm-hmm. that's in the moment on the fly or in a talking head environment. And those skills are pretty different. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
I feel like the technical stuff, especially in the docu world, is like kind of low priority, you know, compared to obviously it's all important. It's all great. And you watch like a Making a Murder or whatever, and you're like, wow, these drone shots are incredible. And this, but the real, you know, half that story is told in like police and interrogation security cameras. You know, it's like, no, there's no art built into how those were captured. It was just, we found this amazing footage and we're going to use it. But the more I work as a director, and the more, you know, I'm constantly pitching against these incredible directors or meeting these incredible directors and seeing incredible directors, the more I realize that the, like you're saying, there's like the, you know, pre-production, production, and post-production. That the production seems, the longer I do this, it seems like the most fun and the least important.
part.
Sure. Process. Or maybe you could change out directors for that production part, and it's
on the day.
And wouldn't be nearly as big a deal as if you change out directors in the like writing, story formulation, like planning part, or changing out directors in the like, and I'm calling them directors, you know, in commercials, a lot of times we don't get to edit our stuff, but, you know, in that putting all the footage together, like the middle, the acquisition of the footage is the easy part.
Yeah.
Well, that's how, I mean, that's how kind of TV runs a little bit, right? Not to like, hopefully step on, like to make anybody feel bad, because TV directors are amazing. And all TV is different too. Right. But, and I think with docs, but like to your point, Matt, first of all, there's such a range of docs now, right? Like, you know, there is kind of like this narrow gaze of like true crime, sports, celebrity, and all that kind of stuff. But like, docs are getting quote unquote incredibly cinematic, right? And that production value is so important to streamers. And then you find like people like a Garrett Bradley who did like Time, which was on Amazon a couple years back. And the point of view through the lens of the camera is just so radically specific. And so I don't think, you know, you can't put
in what ways? I'm not familiar with Time.
Oh, it's an incredible film. Time is a film. It's, you know, by Garrett Bradley, who, you know, it's a black and white 4:3. It's like quote unquote Vimeo staff pick checkboxes, right? In some ways. But like, it is just such an incredible film about a woman trying to get her husband out of jail. But the level of intimacy she's able to really kind of, I don't want to say extract, but just like kind of sit in and live in, it's through her choices with the camera. And it's also through, to your point, Matt, it's through her relationship with the participant in the film too. It's obvious. Like if you watch that film, you could see a documentary filmmaker that both has the technical know-how, knows exactly what she wants. She doesn't know how she's going to get it, because it's documentary. You never fully know how you're going to get it. But you also know that she's built a relationship, and not just like any relationship, like a true friendship, you could tell, which I know is some people would argue against documentary ethics in a way. I don't believe that. But you could see that both the relational and the technical aspects are just like have this perfect marriage. And it's something like singular that she's creating, you know? So I do think those two things matter. Yeah. They matter a lot. Yeah. So the 50 is dropping on April 9th on VOD. So you could rent it, you could buy it. Amazon Prime, Apple TV Plus will be on those two platforms. It's being released by Grasshopper Film, which is a really cool indie distribution company. So yeah, we're releasing it for Second Chances Month.
Awesome. So keep tabs on that, everyone, April 9th. If you want to check out anything else about the film in advance of that, or just like keep tabs. Do you guys have a website? Do you have social media? How can people stay in the loop?
Yeah. So you could go to the50film.com, and it's spelled, or not spelled out, actually it's 50 film.com. And I would implore you to sign up for on email from there. Cause we'll announce different screenings. We're going to actually have a screening in SF, in Los Angeles at USC Film School, your neck of the woods, Matt, coming up in April. Also in
San Diego. And you played a bunch of festivals, looks like Cleveland, Santa Barbara, Big Sky.
Yeah. So we went through our festival run last year, but this is kind of, we're doing a release week kind of like screening events, essentially, where we're going to bring in different speakers, government officials, different people that have connections to the issue area. And we are going to be doing that in kind of major cities in California. So yeah, if you sign up on the site, so you could find us there.
Okay, cool. What about you? Are you on the grams?
I am. Unfortunately, I'm on the grams. Yeah, under Brenton Gieser. It's BrentonGieser. And that is me across the board. You add a .com to that name, and that's my website. So yeah, you could find me on Instagram or online at my website, yeah.
Well, do you have a few more minutes to hang out and endorse with us?
Of course.
Unpaid endorsements.
I have two unpaid endorsements. The first is one after Oren's own heart. It's a chocolate bar from Cho, maybe? C-H-U-A-O? Chocolatier. It's a fancy chocolate bar, specifically the totally tangy mango. It's chocolate with mango and then a little lime a little sea salt, and a pinch of chili in a rich dark chocolate. And literally the reason it took me a second to look it up is because I opened up a bar and I took a photo of it, because if I brought it in just to remind myself, I would have eaten the whole thing during this recording. It's great. It's like a little savory. It's a little weird. You know, it's not like your average chocolate bar, but still totally, you know, satisfies that pure chocolate itch. It is a great bar of chocolate. So let me recommend that. My wife gets them. I think you can get them at Whole Foods, or maybe we do like a CSA box that has like a pantry. And so she'll throw some stuff in there. Cool.
You're going to have to spell that one out on the show notes, right?
That's right. C-H-U-A-O, chocolatier.
I'll check that out.
Ooh, real good. And then my other endorsement is more of a wishy-washy abstract one. I bought an old Russian lens I'd like seen a vlog about on YouTube years ago now, and like played with it a little bit or whatever. And just the other day I was like, oh, it'd be nice to have my camera out. I pulled out like an old like Rebel T2i, like you know, like an old DSLR.
Yeah.
And threw that lens on it, but that lens is so old that essentially, in order to get anything usable, you really it's smartest just to throw it into complete manual mode. So you're just kind of doing everything on the fly, like even adjusting the ISO. And it was really fun, like. I shot many, many, many terrible photos and like a handful of ones that I really love. But like, it's much more active. You're using your skills more. I don't know. It was really fun. And now it's nice to just have that camera just on the coffee table, just out and about around. So like you can think like, oh, I'll grab a photo of this or that or whatever. And it's a little bit more, thoughtful than pulling your phone out. Like, it's great to take a photo on your phone for sure, but there's something a little extra layer of specialness when it's like, you know, a real camera.
I kind of feel like that's why people are like loving Polaroids recently.
Yeah,
because it's kind of like the anti-phone camera. It's like, take it and it's like there forever and it exposed and it looks cool, you know.
Yeah,
I think there's a good endorsement in that where similar to you, man, I have like a Fuji X Pro or something like that, that just kind of lays around the house, you know, and just like on, you know, it's not too smart with kids because it could fall over, but
sure,
just having it lay there, pick it up, you know, there's special moments that happen, quieter moments during the day. Yeah, that's, I like that.
It's like the vinyl vibes for camera people, you know what I mean? Like a little more intentionality in taking your photo. It's pretty nice. Brenton, what you got, bud?
Cool. I also got two. I am gonna shout out a really dear friend of mine named Kyle Rudkin, who's an amazing novelist. He is dropping a book called The 11, and I gotta tell you guys, I have not read it because it's still on pre-order right now, so this is kind of maybe a sellout endorsement, but I gotta do it because I know his work and I love him dearly. But he's an interesting writer because, you know, he touches on, you know, true crime. He touches on a lot of celebrity and pop culture stuff, and even a touch of like existentialism and like all those things kind of like mixed together beautifully. I'm not like the biggest like true crime novel, like fiction novel reader, but with him, of course, I'd love to dig in. And I think this one specifically has some interesting kind of like Hollywood cult vibes, which could be cool. So The 11 by Kyle Rudkin, still available for pre-order right now. It's my first one. Second one, super practical for filmmakers, directing actors. It's a Sundance course. And it's put on by Tessa Blake, who is she's a TV director. I think she's a feature director as well. She's incredible. She's just like, she's the best. She's just incredibly warm, such a great communicator. And what I love about this specifically, like I alluded to, you know, I'm moving to doing more and more narrative work, some narrative shorts, and even writing some features and all that.
It's a video course?
It's a video course. Yeah. So anybody could sign up for it. It's not like a, you know, a Sundance Lab or something like that. It's something exchange money for. You pay, I think, about $300. And then I think there's...
That's $115 right now.
Oh, my God. I got ripped off then. I got ripped off.
I'm seeing one that's $325.
Okay. Are you on collab.sundance.org?
/catalog.
Yeah. Directing actors on demand?
No, directing actors self-paced is what I'm seeing.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I did the self-paced one. I think given that flexibility, yeah.
Do you interact with any people?
So they have, once again, semi-bad endorsement in that I'm not in it, but basically they have a TA person, I think, that like pushes everything along. They have office hours. There's some like workshopping that happens as well that I have not partaken in. But what I'm using it for right now is I go through her modules, and she is like really, she has this process for annotating a script, which is incredibly helpful. And I got a short film that I'm working on right now, and it's like kind of it's a godsend for me in that particular case. And once again, it's just like, she's a fantastic teacher. I think anybody that wants to connect deeper with actors, both from a pragmatic standpoint, but also I think an emotional and personal and human standpoint too, I think she's gonna help you with that.
Kevin, what you got?
I got two. One is just a video that I really, really liked. You told me about Gox, right? This guy on YouTube. GAWX is this kid that makes these like incredible vlogs.
Incredible, yeah.
So do you know who Digital Spaghetti is?
I do.
He's also in Pamplemousse, and he's the co-founder and CEO of Patreon. Yeah.
Wow, a busy guy.
And he's 39 years old, so he's accomplished a lot before 40.
Yeah, not bad.
And he has this video series he's been doing where he just like interviews creators on how they make, like, you know, interview Casey Neistat on like what he's thinking. So he interviewed Gox on like one of his vlogs, and the video is called How Gox Recreates Hollywood in His Bedroom. And he just, you know, Gox will just be like, oh yeah, this overhead shot of like the laptop in my hands. He's like, well, it's actually my dad's hand because I had to like hold the camera. I had it on a tripod on two skateboards and just like
nice.
Moved it sideways. And he literally just goes shot by shot for the first minute of his vlog explaining, this is why I did this opening shot. This is how. He has a brother that looks like a lot like him, Gox. So he'll have his brother sometimes act like him in order to get shot so he can operate the camera. And he'll just shoot his brother as a stand-in for himself. Anyway, it's good. It's short. It's like it's 40 minutes, but you know, I watch everything 2x speed. So 20 minutes if you're me. I think I might have kind of been talking about this. It's just more of a networking thing. I don't know. I've just been doing this thing where if I see work on Instagram that I really like or an ad or something, I like look up the director. And if there's anything that they're doing that I find like remotely interesting or I'm curious about, I'll just like contact them and be like, hey, how do you do this thing? Or what was this? Like, how'd you make your website? And today I had brunch with JJ Adler, who I think will probably come on the podcast at some point, but she directed this like amazing commercial. And I was like, I don't know her. We have like a lot of friends in common, but I was like, hey, I love this commercial. And she was like, yeah, let's grab coffee. And, you know, we talked about pitching and directing and shot lists and DPs and budgets and careers. And it's like, anyone could do this. If you could just find, like, we are not like directors in general aren't famous if you're not like Oscar nominated. So when someone reaches out and is like, hey, I love your work, like, I'd love to hear about how you went from script to shot list, you know, or something specific, and you're not asking them for like a job or to hire you
or to pick their brain.
Well, Brenton, thanks for coming on the podcast and for listening and for being a, you know, just shoot it person.
And congrats on all your success, man.
Your commercial work is incredible. I know we barely talked about it, but it's like, you should check out Brenton. Guys, it's BRENTONGIESER.com. Okay. If you want to find out more about us, you can talk to us. You want to pick Matt's brain You can email him directly. I promise you, he will get this email if you email justshootitpod@gmail.com. You can find us across all social media at justshootitpod. I'm on Instagram at okaplan.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow across all social media. This episode was edited by Noah Bayshore and produced by Tyler Small and Noah Bayshore. And you're listening to music provided by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. Thanks, everyone. Goodbye.
Bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.